and welcome to a new edition of Mercenary Musings Radio, a bi-weekly audio program featuring mining analyst and commodities expert, the mercenary geologist, Mickey Fulp. We are your most trusted source for in-depth analysis and commentary on commodities, mining, and the junior resource sector. Joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is the mercenary geologist himself, Mickey Fulp. Mickey, how have you been?
I've been well, Rob. Just got home from a trip to New York, and I'm going to settle in and watch your New York Rangers take care of Montreal again tonight, I think.
Boy, oh boy, the Rangers disposing of the Penguins after being 3-1 down. That was quite a comeback. And looking pretty good against Montreal. Mickey, I'm hoping for an original six Stanley Cup final. Wouldn't that be a good showdown? Rangers and the Blackhawks. What do you think?
Absolutely, Rob. I'm on board for that.
Okay, well, this is the second part of our special series on carbon. We are focusing on diamonds. So many different angles and talking points to this story, Mickey. We could go on and on and on. Let's begin with the characteristics, though. They are a girl's best friend, so give us a lowdown on the characteristics of diamonds.
Well, it's a cubic allotrope of carbon. They're colorless, metastable at ambient conditions, but the conversion to graphite is negligible. It's so slow. They are hydrophobic, which means they repel water, non-reactive to acids and bases, the hardest of all natural substances known, with a Mohs scale of 10. That's as high as it goes. Highest thermal conductivity, high density, one of the best electrical insulators. And what makes them very valuable for gemstones, they have perfect cleavage in four directions. They are transparent with adamantine luster, which means brilliant luster. As we mentioned, generally colorless with high optical dispersion, which means that when light is shined on them, they break that up, reflect that in many different colors.
Okay, the history of diamonds, Mickey, I believe it was India where they were first discovered several thousands of years ago.
Yeah, about 4,000 years ago, we know that the Indians use them with the Hindus and their many gods as religious icons. They were used as engraving tools, certainly from antiquity too. By the late 19th century, it was known that they were carbon, and that came because a French scientist took a lens and got the sun's rays on it and did it in an atmosphere of pure oxygen and ended up with carbon. By the 20th century, about 1870, the diamond pipes were discovered in South Africa. Before that, they were all alluvial diamonds from rivers or beaches, and that really opened up the industry.
How are diamonds formed in the Earth's crust? I believe, you know, you have to go pretty deep, right, to find out where they originate. I mean, mining doesn't go down 100
kilometers. Yeah, they're formed in the mantle, somewhere 140 to 190 kilometers deep, so well below the Earth's crust. In very specific conditions, 1.0 to 3.3 billion years for their formation, so they form very, very slowly. And compare that to the age of the Earth of 4.5 billion years, so diamonds have been forming, and especially the large diamonds, over a long period of time. They are carried to the surface by these very violent CO2-driven explosions called cryptovolcanic structures, and they are just pipes that basically blow up. So they have a very narrow footprint, very small round footprint. They occur over the stable parts of the crust and the oldest continental crust in Earth, and so they are found in southern Africa, Siberian parts of Russia, Australia, certain parts of Canada, certain parts of the U.S., and Brazil and India, and some other areas, but those are the main places.
What's global production right now, Mickey? How active is the mining business for diamonds? You get married, you got to go out and buy a rock, or else you're going to be in big trouble. Just how big is this industry globally?
Well, in terms of dollar value, it's quite large, especially for the gem portion of it, but the natural mining of diamonds every year is quite small, about 135,000 carats. That's about 26 tons of diamonds, and almost all of that, 80% of that, is used as industrial diamonds. So very small part of its gemstones, but it's quite fascinating. The market was created by De Beers. Cecil Rhodes discovered the first pipes in Kimberley, South Africa in the 1870s. That opened up the diamond market, and it's all about advertising and marketing since there. The latest one from De Beers is a diamond is forever, and certainly they last a long time.
You mentioned De Beers and the fact that, you know, they open up the diamond market. Nice play on words there, because there's really not a lot open about this market, is there? Because it's, I can't think of another industry that is so heavily concentrated and controlled by so few people.
Well, that's true, but it's much less controlled than it was, say, in the 1970s and early 1980s. That's really when things started to change, with the discovery of the, by Rio Tinto, of the Argyle pipe in Australia, and then increasing supplies coming from Russia. At one time in the middle of the 20th century, about 80% of the entire diamond market would have been controlled by De Beers. That's down to about 45% now, but still it's a very concentrated industry. Over 90% of the cut and polishing is done in one location in India. 80% of the world's gem quality and rough cut diamonds are handled in Antwerp, Belgium. 80% of the diamonds are sold in a two-block area of Midtown Manhattan, where I just was, the diamond district of Midtown Manhattan. And then you have other concentrations in London and Tel Aviv and Amsterdam. So it's a very concentrated market, but it's quite big in terms of value. Estimated last year, $23 billion of diamonds sold in the U.S., gem quality diamonds, and that constitutes about 35% of the world's production. So we could say about $70 billion in gem quality diamonds last year.
Wow. Okay. Gem quality, though, in terms of sheer numbers of diamonds pulled out of the earth, that is a minority. I believe you said 80% of the diamonds are basically for industrial purposes, correct?
Well, yeah, and that's the natural diamond market. Then we have to look at the synthetic diamond market. The natural diamond market, even for industrials, is only 3%. So 97% of the world's industrial diamonds are synthetic. And that's dominated again by one country. Of course, that's China. They produce 90% of the industrial diamonds in the world, although the U.S. consumes a significant portion of that, but it's an industry like no other.
This is a great time to have this conversation, Mickey. I'm looking at a news report that came out just over a week ago. You know, we had a blue diamond sold for almost $24 million U.S. at a Christie's auction in Geneva, and there was also just recently an orange diamond sold for $35.5 million. This was back in November. So, you know, mind-boggling prices for this stuff is paid by people who can afford it.
Well, certainly is, and we can go back to the dichotomy of what goes on in this market. Most diamonds are brown, classified as brown in color, then colorless. Then you have this whole area of what's called fancies, starting with the blue diamonds and pink and orange and purple and red, and they have various very small inclusions of other metals in, or other elements in them, such as boron, which will give them a blue color, nitrogen, which gives them yellow color. So most of the diamonds are not what are called these fancies, but these fancies just bring absolutely tremendous prices. They're quite rare. And in fact, small mines, there are diamond mines. I know one specifically in South Africa, a diamond mine, a small alluvial diamond mine, which its total economics and its success will depend on these occasional fancy diamonds that they get.
Okay, that brings up another angle to this story that we always like to bring into the conversation, Mickey, and that is the investability of this kind of thing. I know that, you know, we know the big producers out there, they're very well-known names. What about the junior resource sector in terms of diamond exploration activity? Are there a lot of juniors out there in this area right now?
Well, there are not a lot right now, but this, you know, we had the diamond rush in the early 1990s in the Northwest Territories of Canada, really promulgated by a couple of geologists, one who worked for BHP Billiton at the time, another well-known named Chuck Fipke, who formed a junior company, and they made a discovery. It was quite the geological sleuthing, and that opened up Canada. Rio Tinto came in and developed a big mine up there. There's a couple other juniors that have found mines that are in production now, generally bought out by De Beers or other larger companies. The aforementioned small mine in South Africa, which kicked off last year. So there is always a space in the junior resource sector for diamond explorers. The exploration methods are very well known. The environment's very well known. And so there has been continual success over the years in diamond exploration. Part of the problem, though, in Canada especially, is the expense of exploration being in very remote parts of far northern Canada.
Yeah, I believe that was the Diavik mine, wasn't it, that you were referring
to? Well, the Diavik is the one that Rio Tinto developed, but okay. The Itaki mine was the BHP mine along with Chuck Fipke's company.
In wrapping up, Mickey, what else do you want to touch on here? I think we could go on and on. You know, there's, like I mentioned off the top, there are a lot of different angles to this, aren't there?
Well, there certainly are. Certainly the industrial diamond business is the important thing for cutting tools and grinding, and certainly the new, relatively new techniques for creating synthetic diamonds. There may be increasing uses for semiconductors. All in all, you know, it's there's a glut of diamonds, especially gem quality diamonds worldwide, but good marketing has convinced every woman in the world she's got to have diamonds. You know, used to, there was no market for small diamonds in gems. Now those, every woman wants a big diamond surrounded by a bunch of little diamonds. There was no market for brown diamonds till the Argyle mine, which is dominated by browns, and they create a market where people want brown diamonds before. So, yes, a diamond is a girl's best friend, and it's going to continue for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and all that marketing, you know, puts us guys in a rather uncomfortable position, doesn't it? You know, we're just looking at our wallets getting thinner and thinner.
Well, to each his own, Rob.
Okay. Anything else you want to add, Mickey, in wrapping up here?
I think not. Next time we'll talk about the next most common allotrope of carbon, and that's graphite. We will revisit the graphite bubble.
Okay, good stuff, Mickey. Let's wrap it up on that note. And remember, cheer for those Rangers.
Righto, Rob.
That's Mickey Fulp, the Mercenary Geologist. You can find him on the web at mercenarygeologist.com. And you can always hear Mickey's latest opinion exclusively on mercenarygeologist.fm and kitco.com. I'm Robert Graham at Mercenary Musings Radio. Thanks for listening.